questionnaire which measures personality style, traits, and brain functions, and results in a score called the TPQ, the Trigeminal Personality Quotient. You have to ask a psychiatrist what that is. But that's, it's an accepted test of these sorts of things. The CD is another test, CIDI. This is a structured psychiatric diagnostic interview linked to the ICD-10 and used by the World Health Organization. This is an international standard for diagnosing mental conditions, mental diseases. We use the UCLA WHO auditory memory test, which is a test that measures memory, concentration, attention span, and short-term memory retrieval. And again, these were just ways to get a handle on, you know, how are these people functioning. The second component of this psychological study was to do open-ended psychiatric interviews, which Charlie Crow largely did with Annalisa's self-translating, which was basically just, you know, interviews with each person in the study up to 2 hours. And, you know, some very interesting results came out of that. I'm sorry, I'm losing my voice. Okay, so all this, the field work was done. The stuff is in the freezer. We feel very happy about the way the field phase went. But it's all in the future. What I'm going to show you now is just part of this study, in addition to the physiological work on the human subjects, we're also doing phytochemical analysis. We have to analyze the brews that we used. One research brew was prepared for this study, and they put on a special preparo for us, as they call it, a preparo. And that's what I'm going to show you is this preparo. We collected samples of the brews, samples of the plants, dried, fresh, you name it, and that they all will also be analyzed for alkaloid content. This will give us a handle on when we guesstimated the dose. We gave the subjects 2 milliliters per kilogram of the ayahuasca to standardize the dose in terms of people's body weight. And what we don't have, the missing piece, is we don't know what that's equivalent to in alkaloids because we haven't done the analysis yet. But that will be done, and that'll give us an idea of dose response. This is just a drawing of the Benisteriopsis with the flowers. This is from the UDV's conference in 91. The study was done at the temple in Manaus. The main temple in Manaus is called Núcleo Calpari. Calpari is one of the varieties of ayahuasca that they use. They recognize 2 varieties, Tucunica and Calpari. Calpari is thought to be stronger, have more force as they conceive it. They conceive of the combination of 2 plants as the Benisteriopsis supplies the force, and the chacruna supplies the light. And the calpari, and the light, of course, is the visionary component. But the calpari has a great deal of force and often has a purgative effect. Tucunica is not quite so purgative in effect, and often more light. I quite prefer it. But anyway, they prepared calpari, and that's largely what they have there. And that's the type of vine that they have. Okay, well, here is this is Glaucus, Dr. De Souza Brito, drinking the juice. They've just cut the ayahuasca vine, and the water is flowing out of this vine. And they, you know, it's a bit of jungle lore that a lot of these lianas produce water that's good to drink if you cut them, and it's pouring out of there, and he is just swallowing it. Good water. Interestingly, there's a couple of morphological variants on the Benisteriopsis, which I had never encountered in Peru. Dr. Schultes, you might be interested in this. These nodes on the calpari, you often find these nodes at regular intervals. And, you know, it's even more pronounced in the older stems. And these are meristematic nodes. And the Tikkun Khan does not have this. And have you ever seen anything like that, Professor Schultes? I had never seen it in Peru, but it's not clear whether it's a varietal thing or an environment thing or what.
And that was along the whole length?
It's along the whole length, yeah, but particularly the older stems. Yeah. And they're just cutting it down. This is... Oh. It's moving right along here. This is a close-up of the stem. And, you know, you can see the pattern of the xylem pole. And what's interesting about this are these concentric circles. I don't know if you can see it, but it's actually, it looks a bit like a rose. And the rose has a lot of symbolic significance in the Udavi, and that's what the rose, which you see depicted in the iconography, is meant to represent. Is that true, Ganga? Am I telling crazy stories here? Or? The thing about the rose? But it's this. They told me it was this pattern in the stem that rose motif is really about. Yeah. This is Maestri Florencio. He was the head of the Nucleo Calpari and a very accomplished maestre and a real character. And he was very kind to us the whole time. We had a good time with him. This is the Socotria. It's, or no, this is the Master Office. Now, the interesting thing, unlike Peru, where, you know, it's a one pot kind of deal, this is done on an industrial scale. You know, they made a small batch for the research. I think it was only 50 or 75 liters. Usually they make 500 to 1,000 liters at a time. And these preparos go on for days, round the clock.
Imagine what Sandoz can do with this.
Right.
They grow their own or forage it all in the water.
They gather it, they wash it, and then they get around this these logs and take clubs and they beat it. They beat the stem to a pulp. I don't know how they do it. I did it for 10 minutes and I had blisters for 2 weeks. It's a problem. They're planting it as quickly as they can. They have plantations going, but yes, it's getting necessary to go deeper into the jungle all the time to get the wild stuff, and they do have plantations going. Fortunately, it grows quickly, so I think it's not critical, but. See, when you first beat it, it's white, and then it oxidizes very quickly to reddish brown, some kind of phenolic oxidation process. And then they add the chacruna leaves and this. I'm going to move through this quickly because they wash the leaves first. Now, normally they do it by kind of eyeballing it. It's by the seat of the pants. They don't use a scale or anything like that. Normally, we insisted that they use a scale this time so we could get some data on, you know, what it took to make so many liters and so on. So.
What were the proportions?
The proportions about, you mean of chacruna to about 8 to 1 by weight. Yeah. Don't quote me on that. I have to look at my notes. It was 8 or 12 to 1. I can't remember which. Oh, sorry. So just loading it in here. And,
do they strip the bark off first before they beat it?
No, they don't. They just take the stems and they beat those stems to a pulp, to a, you know, fibers like that. They don't strip the bark, which also differs sometimes from the way they do it in Peru.
Have you ever seen them use any machinery like you would think they would could use one of those rollers for sugar cane, for example?
Right, a chipper, that kind of thing?
Or those, they just have those like a ringer on a washer for sugar cane to express the juice. You think that would work well for crushing the...
I don't think they would do that.
Uh-huh.
They want to do it manually. Consider that sacrilege, or not sacrilege, but there's a thing about it. It's important to interact, you know. They're all drinking at the same time. I mean, you know, you have to drink it while you're doing this, and especially the people that are preparing it. And there's a whole thing about being focused on what you're doing. I mean, in a lot of ways, when you're doing a preparo, these things can go on for days, and there's like a party atmosphere, sort of. It's like a festival. But the people who are actually doing it are very serious and very focused on it. Everybody else is having a great time. They're you know, focused. And they have these, you know, so they boil it. And they build, you know, they do five of these big pots at a time. They put, you know, so this is a big deal. And you can imagine, I mean, it's the Amazon in the middle of the afternoon. It's like it's already, you know, well into the 90s. And then you're hanging around this. They are made out of aluminum, I think. Maybe stainless steel, but I doubt it.
How many processing centers are there?
Every temple. There are 4,000, no, there's about 7,000 members in the Udave all across Brazil, and there are about, how many, Ganga, 50 temples? 100 now? Every temple can do this on some limited scale. Is that true? Often they do collaborate. Two temples will get together and collaborate. They have to have a place to prepare it. And they also plant the plants.
They don't have a corner on the market.
No, there are other groups. There's the Daime, which is just about as big, and they have a completely different ritual and so on, a lot more Christian elements and so on, but they prepare it as well. They call it the Daime, not the Vegetale. But yeah, and there are splinter groups of both the UDV and the Daime. Hard work, you know.
So is it all legal because it's under the
Basically, yes. It's legal because it's a bona fide religion, and the government has looked at this and decided that this is not a problem, and why make a problem out of it? And it isn't a problem. In fact, quite the contrary. It also helps that these people have a lot of connections. I mean, they're smart, you know. Many of them are government workers. They have a lot of professionals, and they understand politics, and they, you know, they're very intelligent, I think, in the way that they go about it.
And that is, when they formulated, when the government formulated a commission to investigate Kuomintang, after several months of investigation, they convinced the guy that he couldn't understand it unless he drank the tea. So he drank it, and he became a member, and
I said they were smart. So here they got the final batches. They're draining it through cheesecloth. It looks just like cafe latte. I mean, it's about that color, actually, except it has this iridescent sheen, which, of course, ayahuasca is famous for, as shown there. the violet cycle fluid. I don't know. Disembodied eyes.
Right.
Checking the final preparo. You see, it looks just like coffee latte. It's kind of a brownish, light brown, not very viscous liquid. So we collected bottles of ayahuasca. We collected source plants, the whole shot, pickled in alcohol and also dried as well.
Do they boil it down just once, or do they do a couple of extractions on the same?
They do a couple extractions. Yeah, they combine it. This fellow here is Jose Cabral. He's a chemist at INCA, who's also involved in the phytochemical work. He's going to be doing some analysis. INPA is this National Institute of Amazonian Research. There were about 20 people are involved, at least 20 people are involved in this project. Well, I'm happy to say that there's a nice balance between Americans and Brazilians and people from other countries as well. I mean, this is not the Americans coming in and doing this work and taking the credit. The Brazilians are, you know, involved in this, just as involved, if not more so than we are, you know. So it's a good thing.
Did you ever use the leaves of the bonsterias?
They don't, as far as I know, not for making the ayahuasca. Although Schultes has reported that they do smoke Banisteriopsis. Sometimes certain tribes Banisteriopsis is smoked.
The whole vine or the bark?
The leaves, I believe. So, Jose Cabral. So that was the preparo. And then we moved into the next phase. This is the window of the temple. This is the temple. It's circular, and this skylight is in the center. Notice the Banisteriopsis flowers and the chacruna leaves in the motif, and the stars. So, you know, very nice temple. And this is where we did the study. This is where they hold the collective sessions most of the time. And since we couldn't arrange for any particular clinical space and didn't really need one, we just set up in here with our centrifuges and sampling equipment and did the study in the temple. We figured that the subjects would be, you know, most at home there because that's where they were used to drinking it. So every day, on the first day we ran one subject, and then as we got into the rhythm of the thing, we ran as many as four at a time. And they would come in, you know, they'd get instructions on what to eat. They all underwent a medical screen initially. They went to the local hospital for that. They'd come in and then they'd get wired up and, you know, to the blood pressure devices, and we do a catheter, essentially a heparin lock kind of thing, so we could access the blood, and then they would get the ayahuasca and stay around, and we would collect samples of plasma at different time points. We also collected urine. We collected cumulative urine through the end of the day, and we also collected the first urination the next day after they woke up. They were instructed to bring that back, and they did. So a lot of plasma material was collected. This was our first subject, first day. And these people were so cooperative. I mean, you know, they were really so happy to be in this study. It was considered a great honor. And this guy, you know, after the study went on about, he felt like he was a pioneer, and he felt like, you know, this really increased his status in the UDV and made it, you know, he understood that he was making history. Because a lot of what the study, I mean, it all fits in with their mythology and their prophecies. I mean, this is stuff that their founder, Mr. Gabriel, talked about many years before that this would, you know, this kind of thing would be done. So, you know, these people are absolutely enthusiastic about doing it. There's another one of our. So at periodic time intervals, we, here's some of it. Here's Jace Calloway, Annalise, Charlie Grove, Glaucus, the doctor from the hospital in Manaus, his name I forget at the moment.
Extractions
all
during your trip?
Absolutely. Sure.
That didn't bother them.
Huh?
That didn't affect their space that they were in? Or
they weren't even, it didn't bother them a bit.
How are you feeling now?
The women all take it to give birth, and they go in for an operation, they drink the tea before they go into the hospital for an operation.
Yeah. He said he.
You have to go past the blank space. I'm at the.
Is that? That's it.
Yeah. Go 10 more.
Yeah, I mean, he just said after all this, taking all this blood and poking and prodding the guy after the session, he said, how, you know, how was that for you in the trip? And he said, the trip was all about giving myself. Giving my body substance to the experiment, which of course is exactly what was happening. But, you know, I mean, he was into it. He wanted to do it. It was this whole, you know, mystical thing about the, I don't know, the word made flesh or something.
And all 15 were wired during the trip?
Mm-hmm. EKG. This is another one of the physicians from the hospital.
How many subjects were in the study?
15 subjects in this acute study. There were no controls in the acute study. The 15 subjects were their own controls. When they came in, when they reported for the study, we took blood samples at 30 minutes before they drank and at zero time when they drank. So those were baseline samples to give us an idea of changes in these parameters. So that was how we controlled. The long-term study had two different groups, users and non-users. A lot of blood samples, a lot of not the best conditions to do this under. I mean, I would have worried about exposure to blood, but I feel like probably with the UDV, there's such a decent bunch of people, I doubt that they have any venereal diseases. He's over, coming out. This is a small part of the research team and the people of the Nucleo Capere that helped make our study successful. With a really fine bunch, and we're grateful to all of them, tremendously grateful. And our hope is that we can justify their confidence in us, because they're convinced that this is, that this is going to make a difference, and this will be their, in some way, foot in the door as far as getting it approved in the United States. They feel that they want to do this, and they have to present this kind of data to show that it's not harmful, it's not toxic, before anyone will even listen to them about the larger religious freedom issues involved here. So, you know, as we said, they're helping us do work that we've wanted to do for many years. And we're helping them. We're all part of each other's program here. Okay, that's it for me. Maybe we'll have minimal questions so John can get on with it. I know I've gone on for a long time.
Could you describe their ceremony as a ritual? What goes on, how long it lasts?
Maybe Ganga would be a better person to describe that. He's more intimately familiar with the that aspect of it, since you are a member, right? In good standing. More or less good standing. Maybe you should describe that.
Yeah, you drink the tea, they wait about an hour. During that hour, there's music, sometimes some announcements and logistical kind of things are read, business or news. And they very carefully select the music that's going to be, and the mysteries who conduct it, they're called mysteries or masters, these sessions very orchestrate the whole session with music according to the effect they want to create. And after about an hour, they start feeling the effects, they start doing magical chants to bring on the effects in a certain way. And then sessions are all, they last about 3 hours after that. Usually they start at 8 and finish at midnight, and most of them at night, although they do some at high noon. And the sessions can vary a lot. Sometimes there's a lot of talking, sometimes people are sharing and asking questions about personal things, their life, spiritual, psychic, anything, complete gamut. Sometimes the mastery, some of the counselors are giving talks, inspired in response. Sometimes there's silence. And then it finishes, and the elephants that hang around the temple for 3-4 in the morning. The session usually finishes at midnight or 1 a.m.
How many people might be in that?
In the bigger cities, up to 200. And anywhere from 20 to 200.
And you can hear a pin drop in the room. Another aspect, I just wanted to add something to what Ganga said, you know, a marked contrast between the way the tea is used in Brazil and the way it's used in Peru is that in Peru it's almost always about curing, and it's about, you know, there is a medical aspect to the thing. And in Brazil, although individually people will tell you that it's cured them of this or that, or they think it has healing properties, but there's no formal utilization of that within the UDV. I mean, they don't consider it a medicine, they consider it a spiritual thing. And in fact, they're concerned not to medicalize it. They're afraid if they medicalize it, then they'll be faced, you know, just like if we were to try and bring it out as a drug here in the States, the FDA, if, you know, would be have all kinds of questions. So it's not really about curing, it's about self-discovery and about, well, Charlie says, you know, it's about, I mean, part of it is that from the psychiatrist's point of view, it makes you hyper-suggestible. So you get people in this hyper-suggestible state, and then you feed them full of all sorts of, you know, notions about the right way to behave, how to be decent to other people, and this kind of thing. So in that sense, it's much like other cults, other religions, you know. But the ayahuasca is a vehicle for transmitting the doctrine, and it's not really medical in its purposes.
You're very active in social service work.
Very active, right.
There's a lot of doctors in just about every temple, and the members come on Saturday. They usually have a pre-clinical on that. They have dentistry clinics, medical clinics, they're also have a very advanced project.
They're very environmentally active and socially active. That's right. Yeah. Yes, that's an important thing that should be looked at. I don't. Yes, I do. The question was, are we going to look at the immune response? Not this time around, but I think we will look at it differently. No. Well, I mean, possibly too, on the psychological level, yes, but as a treatment for HIV, I doubt it. Psychologically, it could be a great help, yeah. Also, I think maybe it's one of its most promising applications is drug addiction and alcohol abuse. Many of these people, when we did the open-handed psychiatric interviews, you know, there's a typical story. It's basically, you know, many of them said that they were completely out of control and they were engaged in a variety of self-destructive behaviors. Alcoholism, wife beating, drug addiction, just out of control and psychologically dysfunctional, many of them. And then they claim that after coming to the T and also the context of the Unyao and the social support that you get within that group cannot be neglected here. It's not just the T, but it's helped many of these people to turn their lives around and give up drugs and basically get back on track. Some still do. It's not that it's an instant cure. It helped people to get a handle on it, you know. It's interesting, in Peru, tobacco is a constant element of using ayahuasca. I mean, the ayahuascaeros and the people that take it smoke all the time, and they smoke during the ayahuasca, and it's involved ritualistically with the whole ceremony. In the UDV, I didn't meet anyone who smoked. It's not that there's a prohibition against it any more than there's a prohibition against drinking. It's just that it seems that after a while, when people are taking it regularly, they just don't. They just stop. You know, they seem to have certain perceptions about healthy behaviors, and they're just kind of naturally led to, you know, a more healthy kind of lifestyle, respect for their bodies, that sort of thing. Yes?
What is the active ingredient, psychoactive agent of the psychotria?
Dimethyltryptamine.
So it really sounds like the Banisteriopsis has always gotten the focus. All the reading I've done, but essentially it plays the role of the myohemine oxidase inhibitor.
Right.
But really, the hot stuff, if you will, is the psychotropin.
Well,
the Banisteriopsis itself is not, upon its own, is a psychoactive.
Somewhat. But I don't know if you could call it visionary, you know. I mean, I think the UDV's model that, you know, it's a balance between the force and the light is really a good model. And the more you take it, the more you work with it, the more you understand sort of the wisdom of that perception. You know, the chakruna, the psychotropia, supplies the light, and Banisteriopsis supplies the force. And it's to achieve a balance between those. I asked the guy, one of the mysteries, I said, why not, how come you don't put more chakruna in it? Why don't you really amp up the chakruna so it'll be a, you know, extremely visionary brew? And he said, well, you know, you don't want to overexpose the film, right? Because then all you see is a white light, or all you see is, you know, you completely overwhelm it. You lose, what's the word, resolution. It's, you know, it's that you want to, you know, flash out and just completely saturate. Or perhaps it's better to tone it down and get some texture to the thing. I thought that was an interesting way to do it. I'm sorry, my voice is giving out on me, and I think I better let John take over at this point.